Yes, it's that time of the week where we talk all things animals. Pet Chat with Cheryl Shaw and Dr. David Tabrett. Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hello.
Neither of you knew which one to say first.
I thought David might have been going first because it's been a while since he's been on air.
It has.
It feels like yesterday. But Does no, it? It's been a couple of months. So I'm so glad to be back in the seat today.
It's nice to have you.
Thank you.
Nice to have you.
Yeah. I'm sure you're going to get a lot of calls too, David.
Lots of calls.
I hope so.
I hope so.
Now, Cheryl, you're going to talk about dog bowls today.
Yeah. How we feed our dogs is really important. Now, if you've got a senior dog, so a dog that's older, a dog that may have some arthritis, be stiff, may have some problems with its spine or some other issues health-wise, sometimes it's better that we look at how we are feeding them. Often people just put the bowl down on the floor and the dog goes over to the bowl. Now, dogs with those problems that we were just saying sometimes can't really bend easily. So it's quite difficult for them to go down. So even, and particularly more so your bigger dogs, so not so much your smaller dogs have the issue, but your larger breeds tend to have real struggles trying to bend their necks down to their bowl. So in these breeds, it's recommended that you use a higher bowl, so an elevated bowl. And again, you just need to make sure that the elevation is correct. You don't want it to have it too high, because if it's too high, the dog is going to struggle to get the food out. And that's just going against what we're trying to achieve. So one of the things we want to do is have that elevated bowl just to make the eating easier. Now, I have two dogs. One of my dogs, Mystique, is fed from the floor. She's a young, healthy, active dog and no health problems. So she's fed just in the bowl off the floor. My other dog has megaesophagus, so he has to be fed from an elevated bowl. So for him, that's the right way to do it. And David, that's the thing with some dogs. They just can't swallow the food as they're either got a health problem or if they're aged. So if they can't swallow, then we have a potential for them aspirating their food and things can go terribly wrong.
Yeah. Megaesophagus in particular, and I guess it's probably worth just mentioning how a dog actually can eat from the food that's below them.
Yes.
You know, what's involved. And they actually, when they pick up the food with the front of their mouth, they might chew it a little bit, but usually they'll just eat. They literally throw it into the back of their throat, and then it activates a swallow reflex when it hits the back of the throat. And that's so the airway closes over and then the esophagus opens and it moves into the esophagus. But now it's there, it's got to go up because their head's down.
Yes.
And so then we get these waves of muscle activity. And this is what we call an autonomic activity. So it's not, you don't have to think how to swallow, right?
No.
You don't coordinate your own esophagus to go, okay, the top has to contract. And then so it actually automatically happens and they get these waves of muscular activity that kind of push it along as if you're pushing toothpaste out of a tube, okay? And that's how they get it into their stomach. And then it gets all the way down through the chest and it falls into the stomach.
Yes.
So if you have any kind of disease or nerve or muscle problem that affects that esophageal muscles and it blocks that peristaltic activity, the swallowing activity, then that means if they try and throw the food into the back of their mouth, it may well sit in the esophagus, but their head's down and then it just falls back out because it won't go anywhere.
That's right.
So that's when you said about, okay, they're elevating. So now what we've done is we've tipped the esophagus and lifted their head above their chest.
Yep.
So now the food will just work by gravity.
Yep. So it's going to fall into the stomach rather than sitting in the esophagus and then that potential for other things happening that aren't so great. And that's, again, with not just like with my dog, with the megaesophagus, but myasthenia gravis is, again, that one that just stops that swallowing of the muscle is not strong enough to take it down. So dogs with these problems really do benefit from having that elevated bowl. But you need to check your dog to make sure that, you know, it's eating properly. And again, as dogs age, their eating requirements lessen. They don't need as much because they're more sedentary. So checking your dog, checking the position of the bowl, you know, over the lifetime of your dog, it's going to alter. So making sure that you're just keeping aware of that. Now, sometimes with elevated bowls, there is a little bit of discussion. I know this in the vet circle that they say, oh, sometimes an elevated bowl will cause bloat in some dogs, but that's not necessarily so. But it is something that you'll sometimes read because there's a lot of factors that go into bloat, I believe. Yep. I've had one dog who got bloat, but fortunately you guys saved her.
What is bloat? Is it like bloating?
Bloat is kind of the colloquial term that applies to a condition called gastric dilatation and volvulus. So, or we call it GDV. Mm-hmm. And dilatation just means exactly that. The stomach gets bigger, blows up, hence the bloat. The volvulus is where it actually twists. So if you get this big bloated stomach and then it twists, then they can end up in very perilous circumstances and potentially die without emergency surgery. And the question is about when this bloat occurs, as Cheryl's alluding to, is it because they've swallowed air because they had their bowl up? But that kind of doesn't really make sense because, yeah, as I just said before, they throw the food into the back of their throat, right? So they're still going to get some air into their gastrointestinal tract that way.
Yes, yeah.
So it's other factors to do with motility in the stomach that are more predominantly a cause of bloat.
And I always thought that, well, it's not scientific, but I've always thought those dogs that are higher stress tend to be the ones that...
Oh, yes.
Yeah, so this particular poodle I had with bloat, she was a really stressed dog, super fit, but, yeah, bloat, yeah, it's a terrible demon.
Yeah, there does tend to be an association with anxiety disorders in dogs, in certain dogs.
Yep, yeah.
For sure.
Yeah, but certainly check out your dog bowl. Just see how your dog is eating, whether it's able to get that food properly, whether there's some underlying other issues, just not from age but from health, you know, reasons. Get your vet to check it out if you're concerned about anything and make sure that you're, you know, feeding your dog the way that it's going to be easier for the dog to access the food. And you won't need a high chair.
No, that's the other thing. For dogs that are very severely affected with megaesophagus, which just means large esophagus, and Cheryl mentioned myasthenia, that's a disorder where the muscle is not working properly caused by an immune disease. But some of those dogs are actually born in that way. Mm. Well, it comes on at a very young age. Mm. And for those dogs, we actually put them in a thing called a Murphy chair.
Bailey's chair.
Bailey's chair. I knew it was one of those drinks. The Bailey's chair is basically, it's kind of taking it to the extreme where now the dog is actually vertical. Mm. So they look like a kid in a high chair.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, and so then when the food goes in, it's only got one way to go. It just goes straight through to the stomach.
So what sort of dogs does it affect?
Well, hopefully small ones.
Because if you've got big ones.
Otherwise, well, the problem with megaesophagus is it does tend to predominate in larger breed dogs.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So my dog doesn't have to sit in the high chair, but I do need to elevate his bowl.
Mm. Right, there you go. Now, David, you have been overseas recently.
Well, I actually just realised, because I did say that to you in the break, but since I was last here, I might have been to 4 conferences. And I can only remember one thing, which I wanted to talk about today.
You've had a big couple of months.
Oh, look, it's all sunk in. It's sunk in. It's in there. It's in there. Now, the most recent conference that I really enjoyed going to, but for a whole lot of reasons, was the International Veterinary Emergency and Critical Care Symposium. And there was about 4,500 people at this conference in the States, in the US. Importantly, the piece that I wanted to just bring up today, kind of, and it gets a little bit nerdy, so...
I love a bit of nerdiness.
Oh, you sure?
I'm all about the nerd.
Oh, okay, let's go into it. A little bit of statistics. So one of the things that I do as a practitioner and I guess as a teacher is I'm a certified CPR instructor for pets, okay? And there's this scheme called RECOVER, which is evidence-based guidelines for CPR. So, and it's a very popular scheme, and we've got training going on all the time. And for most veterinary staff, we're trying to improve our survival for pets that have CPR. And you might think, well, that's, you know, that's nice, but really, how often does it happen? And look, in an emergency hospital like where we work, I've been on shift where we've had 3 happen.
In one shift?
In one shift, yeah. Oh. Yeah. Mm. And 2 at once, one time, where we had to do CPR. So the problem that we get is that from, I guess, the perception around there is, and this is really in the veterinary space I just wanted to focus on, is that the survival is not very good. And I have to admit that's kind of one of the points of why RECOVER was developed, because we wanted to improve that survival rates. Okay, it's been going for about 10 years, 12 years now. And so we're actually also collecting data on worldwide patients that have had cardiac arrest, and we've given them CPR and see what happens. And so from the perspective of, I guess, a pet owner or member of the public, you know, one of the things we know about CPR, if you watch television, is for humans is, well, if you're around when one of those rescue shows are on, not the Australian ones are actually pretty realistic, to be honest, but it's some of the American ones, the survival's like 100%. It's really not that case, you know. So the survival's kind of 20 to 30% depending on the scenario. From the veterinary perspective, our background is survival was around about 1 to 2%. So we had, we had a lot of work to do, a lot of work in training, but also understanding what causes it. And I won't worry about going into all of that. But these are the updated statistics, and that's kind of the point I wanted to get to. So what we do now is we can actually look at this point where the we'll just say a dog, same for cat, but for a dog, say, from all the animals that we do start CPR on, the percentage who actually will get a heartbeat back and breathing is actually now 36%.
That's wonderful.
Right? So that's within the kind of 15 minutes or so. Mm-hmm. Then there's a couple of time points that we look at because some of them have got certain diseases or their heart is failing or some other reason that they've arrested in the first place, they may arrest again. And so the survival then drops down to about 15% at 2 hours. Now, some of that is that we may do CPR, and we've had this experience in our hospital where we do CPR, talk to pet owners because that's what they wanted us to do, and then we talk about what's going on. And we decide, are we going to continue with treatment? So there is those time points where we're understanding the severity of the disease. And so at 2 hours, it's about 15%. 24 hours now, the survival's about 7%. So again, we've got that time. It might be due to disease. It might be that, look, we've been able to resuscitate your pet, but, you know, contrary to what you might think when you watch television and so on, not many people and not many dogs for that matter, you do CPR and they just roll over, cough and get up. Mm. That's not how it works. You know, they're very, very sick. They need to be in intensive care and so on. So at 24 hours, it's about 7%. And then the next time mark is 21 days later. Yeah. So that's kind of where we really say, okay, can you make it that far? And we're about 3 to 5%. So we're seeing this where we're losing a patient further, but 3 to 5% is still 2 to 3 times better than it was, what it was 10 years ago.
Yeah, definitely.
So that's a landmark.
So it's but progress.
It is progress, but what we do want to do is continue to work on improving our post CPR care, where we can actually get these animals to a more sustainable quality of life, and that was really a big part of the reason I wanted to go to that conference was to explore those areas.
It sounds really interesting, and so I've just got a question about CPR because, I mean, as humans, we're expected and it's hoped that we will do CPR courses to help each other. Can pet owners do CPR courses to help their pets?
That's a really good question because obviously, like, I could go out and say, well, I'm going to teach some CPR, but do we know what's going to be effective? Because when I teach it in a veterinary hospital, it's like, oh, you've got to have these drugs available, you've got to have these tubes available and maybe a defibrillator and things like that. So when we go outside and we talk to pet owners, it's about we teach what we call basic life support. So there's basic life support and advanced life support, which are all those other bits I just mentioned. And so if we look at basic life support, then there are things that pet owners can do. And one of the things, and Cheryl and I were talking about this just before, was, you know, how do you know if your pet's potentially had an arrest and that sort of scenario? What do you do? Mm. So there is actually a training course that's being developed and improved. And I think there is today's Wednesday, isn't it?
Yes.
tomorrow afternoon there's actually, for pet owners, there's a course being run at the community centre at Charlestown.
Oh, wonderful.
So that you can provide those circumstances where your pet may have had a reason where you suspect they've had an arrest, then what you can do in that very quick window before you get them to the vet.
That's great.
So, yeah, and it's not fully developed all of the resources for us to be able to teach that more broadly, but it's very close. I mean, when I say very close, I mean like a couple of weeks away.
Yeah, that's great. But progress. Love
it. If people are interested, they can look at the community, Charlestown Community Centre, and check the details.
Fantastic. Now, we're just going to start with Pet of the Week. We've got Bobby,
isn't he cute?
Yeah.
Little Bobby.
Nine-month-old.
Yeah.
Yeah, looking for its forever home.
I can't look at that screen for too long or else I might have to ring up and adopt him.
And he's only young, which is really nice because you've got all of that good times ahead, nine months.
Right, yeah, exactly.
Absolutely beautiful. Constantly playing with other kittens in the foster care and loves to snuggle with older cats, and he loves his humans. So if you like to snuggle with cats, then
I did note in the information that we've got about Bobby is a – thinking he'll be good with other cats in a house, so or with people around, he's going to be good as well if he's on his own.
Yep, sounds good. All right, and we've got Bear. Bear is a little cute little doggy.
Bear looks a little bit mischievous to me.
Yes.
Okay. It's in his eyes.
It is. He's outgoing and confident once you've gained his trust. Bear would love to be able to rumble with a canine sibling. His days are spent either sleeping, eating or playing chases in and around the garden. He sounds like he's got a bit of energy and he's very focused on his people person. Extremely affectionate and will happily follow you around most of the day. And he's being part dingo. The flight or fight response is strong, which means he is initially cautious around new people and surroundings and shouldn't be forced into interactions he isn't ready for. They're seeking an experienced owner.
Yeah, I think that's really important when you've got a dingo cross because you just don't know what you're going to be in for. So you need a bit of experience so it's not a first-time dog owner.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. All right, and going to the phones, we've got George from Rathmines on the phones. Hi, George. How are you going?
Good, thanks.
That's good. You've got a 14-year-old Foxy Cross Maltese. It's got problems with eating.
Yeah, it seemed to come on him. I suspected he'd caught something because it didn't seem in character. And I've got that way. I've got to sort of con him about eating his food. Like he's had a history of it living on chooknecks broadly. We also make him a stew.
Yep.
And to keep his bowels nice and working. But he was having trouble with the chooknecks, and so we've chopped them up in the small pieces, which makes it easier for him to eat. And he does seem to... I mean, he's quite happy to eat chooknecks all day long.
Yeah. So what's he actually doing now with his food, George?
Well... when I, in past times, a week or two back, I'd just put it in his plate and he'd knock me over on his way to clean it up.
Yep.
But now I've got to kid him along and I put the stew out first to make sure he's got something moving his bowels, you know.
Oh, yeah.
But... whereas he used to love the stew too, but he's very negative about it, and so I've got that way. I put a little bit of stew, and he's not stupid. He picks it up and goes and hides it, and so that I think he's eating it.
Okay, all right. Now, does he have any other symptoms of ill health?
Only that he's slowing down, but then he is 14, and I sort of thought, but it's not predictable. Some days he's like a hairy goat, and some days he isn't.
I'd just be, as you've noticed, like even though it's come on rather suddenly, at 14 years of age, certainly there can be the kind of slow developing problems and then suddenly they seem to be more of an issue. Now, the problem is, I guess, is you just don't know which system we want to focus on, because, you know, going off his food a bit, it's a very non-specific problem. It could be just his teeth, or it could be that he's got, you know, heart disease. Like, I mean, it can be that far apart. So I really think it's time for a visit to the vet, and they'll actually be able to listen to his chest. They'll be able to palpate his belly, go through things, have a really good look at his mouth as well. Make sure all of those things are going okay, because we really need to peel back what's going on. And, you know, if you're very astute, as you've noticed, he's just gone off his food and he's had this history of being really good with eating. This is a sudden thing. I'd be thinking we need to get him off to the vet straight away for a checkup, because I think there may be one of those problems that I talked about. So, look, get him checked in, and hopefully if you get an answer there and give us a call back, we'd really appreciate that.
Okay, all the best with that, George. Okay, next on the line we have Roz from Shoal Bay. Hi, Roz.
Hi.
You've got a blind dog and with an itchy eye.
Well, she's a Jack Russell Cross, and she went blind in one eye, and that was probably about 6 months ago now, and then the other one went. But she's had an itchy allergy. I think a lot of it's to do with flicks of feet a lot, and she's had a skin condition. But I've got that under control. Mm-hmm. But when she tends to rub her face up against. She sits on the lounge, obviously. I don't need a bowl on the floor because she gets hers at the table. At the
of course, she does. Yes.
She does. And so when she's sometimes when she goes to the toilet as well, when she uses the bath, she roars in and jumps up and rubs her face up against the fabric over the lounge. And then she's doing it with her face as well. And the eyes obviously itchy. And I just wondered if there's anything I can put on it to help. I got it the other day, and I got just a wet, compress thing, and just held that on it for a while, and she just sat still and let me do it, and then every now and then I just get a pad thing and just wipe around it. But I just wondered if there's anything apart from going to the vet that I can put on. I've got some, I think it's called Clawsig. I think it's an ointment for conjunctivitis.
Yes. Yep.
And I got it from the chemist with another cream to mix together to put on the skin for the itch. The chemist said that would help. And I don't want to put it on or near her eye. I just wondered if there's anything else I can do that can ease it a little bit or relieve it a little bit.
Now, how old is your Jack Russell?
Well, she's basically celebrating her 9th birthday today.
All right. And you said that she's, happy birthday to her. So you said that she went blind in one eye. About 6 months ago.
Probably about that, yeah.
Do we know why she went blind?
No, I don't really know. I was, I just sort of looked at her and I could see this sort of film come across her eye and and I said, oh, I hope not. But it didn't seem to bother her. She still carried on and did all this stuff she does.
So it is, it's cloudy across the eye though.
Yeah. Both of them.
It sounds like she... It sounds like she does have corneal disease, so that's keratitis, and it could be caused by allergies, and those things can, if they self-traumatise with an allergy is what happens. The allergy doesn't actually damage the eye. It's her rubbing around her face. Look, I've got a pretty low threshold for eye problems, and I understand, you know, you were saying about with these medications, but the problem with particularly if they self-traumatise, they can damage the surface of the eye. And then if we put the wrong thing in there, we're going to make it a lot worse. So I do think with eyes, we really need to get to the vet and have a look. We, as a vet, what we're doing is we're looking for evidence of that conjunctivitis and evidence of trauma to the surface of the eye. So we'll often put a stain into the eye and just see... we use a special light to be able to look and see where it might be taken up, the stain. And that's indicative of surface trauma to the eye that probably needs a specific treatment. So whilst the Clawsig is a very common treatment for these sort of non-specific problems, as I said, with particularly when you start talking about getting it from the chemist where they're not qualified to actually look at the eye itself. They may be able to dispense those products, but ultimately this is a problem I think we need to get to the vet. And hopefully with that, we can reverse what's happened. I'm not sure about the one that's gone blind, but with the other eye, if we can at least slow it down or reverse it, we don't want her to lose all her vision.
Yeah. Ros, another thing just to add to that, meanwhile, before you're going off to your vet is a great solution for this, but I think one of the things to prevent her from rubbing her eye on the fabric of the lounge, which can be creating more abrasion to that eye, if you get a little inflatable e-collar and put it on the dog, it'll stop her from being able to reach the fabric and rub that eye, causing more problems.
Yes, we want to slow it down as much as possible.
I'll just say something about the cream that I got. I got it with a cortisone cream as well, but it wasn't for her eye.
No,
that's right. It was for the body, for the itch on the body. So the vet said with the Clorsig, the two of them together. So that I haven't put anything on her face except a wet cloth. And one of the eyes is the worst than the other one. I think she can see a little bit.
Yes.
Night time, and when we get into bed and just get settled, she looks out the window and starts barking and barking and barking.
Maybe she's seeing things that aren't there. And I was, when you mentioned that earlier about the other ointment, I knew that it was going to have cortisone in it. That's the one we want to stay well away from, and in particular with eyes, because that can send things bad pretty quickly. So I think it's best to get the vet to have a good look at it.
Okay, all the best with that, Ros. This is Pet Chat on 2NURFM, and we've got David from Weston on the line. Hi, David.
Hello.
How you going?
Good. I've got a six-year-old my daughter says she's a blue Kelpador. Her father's a blue Labrador cross, and the mother's a Kelpie Collie cross. So she's a blue Kelp Halpador, but she's very much working dog nature, and you know, sort of Kelpie Collie size, but black Labrador. Now, her entire life was I've got very bad arthritis. I'm in my late 70s. And I used to take her up the park and toss balls with a ball thrower.
Yes.
And she'd do that for 20 or odd minutes till she was exhausted, tell me she was exhausted, and we'd come home. Early this year, she absolutely shattered her cruciate ligament in her rear right leg, tore the front half of the meniscus.
Yeah.
And she's now got a lot of metal in that leg, and I was told she can never chase balls again. It's now forbidden, you know, and
yes,
she's likely to do the other one. And I was told walk her. So 2 grand later, I bought a mobility scooter, so I try and walk her a fair bit. But I was told that it's okay for her to play sort of pulling, you know, or tugging type games. Is that okay with the operation she's had on her leg?
So how long ago did she have the operation?
Oh, she's fully recovered from it. It was about February, I think.
Oh, okay. Yeah. The reason why we don't want her chasing bulls is because this is the mechanism that causes her to damage the other ligament, the other leg. And so when they come down and they twist at the same time, that's what tears the ligament. And so it's just really to try and reduce the risk that she is going to develop that bilateral problem occurring in the other leg. But the any straight line exercise is probably good. Swimming is number one, the best, and particularly for a dog that has a lot of energy, swimming will wear them out a lot quicker than ball throwing.
Yeah, but she hates water.
She hates water.
I've got one of those little, you know, wader pool things. If I put a toy in it, she won't even put one.
I see. Well, she's not much of a Kelpie, is she? Go and jump in a dam.
We've got about 30 seconds, David. So, can you answer the question in 30
yes,
seconds?
Yes, any straight line exercise should be fine.
So aggressive tugging is okay?
Yeah, well, you know, it's as long as she doesn't twist her legs. Because if she's pulling forward, that's fine. So
yeah, well, she's pulling backwards, I'm holding. Yeah.
Oh, okay, yes.
Yeah,
no. that should be fine, but as long as she's not twisting at the same time.
Okay. All the best with that, David. We are out of time. We've had a great show. Thank you so much. This is Pet Chat, and the winner is of the voucher is David from Weston. Thank you so much. We'll be in touch. This is Pet Chat on 2NURFM 103.7.
Thanks for listening to this podcast from 2NURFM at the University of Newcastle. You'll find them all at 2NURFM.com.